Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Alpha Chat, the business and economics podcast from the Financial Times. I'm Amy Keene. We're doing something a little different on today's show. Our colleagues in Brussels, Jim Brunston and Alex Barker, they recently sat down with Thomas Wieser, one of the key figures in Eurozone policymaking over the last decade. And they got together to mark the fact that Mr. Wieser is about to step down as president of the Eurogroup Working Group. We're going to get right to it today. I'll leave the rest of the introductions to Jim. Here it is.
Hello, I'm Jim Brunston, EU correspondent for the Financial Times in Brussels. With me is Alex Barker, the FT's Brussels bureau chief. And we have the great pleasure to welcome to our podcast studio, Thomas Wieser. Put simply, no one has been more in the thick of the euro area's efforts to overcome the sovereign debt crisis than Mr. Wieser. His role, which he's held for more than 6 years, puts him at the centre of all the work that goes on to prepare meetings of euro area finance ministers in Brussels. It was a job that during the crisis meant navigating painful all-night negotiations on everything from bailing out Greece to creating European-level supervision of euro area banks. His colleagues describe his approach to the role as being the calm voice of reason while everyone else is shouting, while he himself has said the task is similar to that of a marriage counsellor. Thomas, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So I think a good place to start is to explain to the listeners a bit more about you and a bit more about the role. Can you tell us a bit about your career leading up to the presidency of the Euro Working Group and also give us a sense of what that job entails?
Oh, goodness. It's a bit difficult to describe my career because I've always been a foreigner somewhere. It's a bit like Sting, isn't it? an alien in New York, and I've always been abroad in a way. Seeing that my background is Austrian and English and American and a couple of others as well. My career has alternated between international organization, national administration, banking, and also a bit of academia until I realized that academia was better off without me. And over the years, as I moved upward in the Austrian Ministry of Finance, the international part of my work became more and more time-consuming, chairing an OECD committee, chairing the Economic and Financial Committee and the Eurogroup Working Group of the European Union from 2009 until 2011, at which time, after 2 years in that job, next to my Vienna job, I didn't seek a renewal of my mandate, telling ministers that they had to look for another idiot who was capable and willing to do both jobs at once. And lo and behold, they found a volunteer, a very courageous volunteer. But at the end of the year, it became apparent that this had to be a full-time job as Europe and the euro area specifically were in deep trouble. And that's how I came to set up shop at the beginning of 2012, full-time job here in Brussels. And I've been here for 6 years. People ask me to describe my job. What is it that you actually do? It's something my mother used to ask me for decades. And I said, well, I go to meetings and I talk on the phone. And she said, and people get paid for that? And I said, yes, well, sort of. That was Austria. And I've at times likened it to being a marriage counselor, which indeed I think we've been quite successful at preventing divorces over the past years. And sometimes I try and describe my job as a garage mechanic. My job is to make sure that the tires are pumped up, there's gas in the tank, the wheels are greased, etc., etc., so that when the politicians, the ministers, get into the car and Jeroen Dijsselbloem, or whoever was the chair, is in the driving seat, the car can leave safely and hopefully find the next destination. A third way of describing it, maybe the difference between myself and my successor, is I was the guy who was driving the fire engine, and the guy who comes after me is much more constructive. He'll be the architect of deepening economic and monetary union and banking union and all that stuff.
And of course, your fire engine was spending a lot of time towards the south of this continent on Greece. And I thought we'd maybe start with your reflections on something that really has been with you throughout your time at the Euro Working Group. And to think back to the start of this, and can you remember the moments when the first reveal came in terms of Greece's situation, how difficult it was going to become, and how prepared or not so the Euro area was to deal with it?
I recently had a discussion with George Papakonstantinou, who was the Greek finance minister, when the first fiscal problems emerged right after the elections, nearly 10 years ago. And he was the guy who entered the room and said, "Good afternoon, I'm the new Greek finance minister, and we've been having a look at the deficit figures, and it emerges that they are not 5 point something, but they are much higher, much, much higher." And in the end, they turned out for that year to be 15.6% of GDP, which of course is spectacular, and some basic arithmetic shows you that within 4.5 years, you would be doubling debt to GDP ratios, which is a sort of shortcut answer to those who said, well, austerity should not have been part of the solution for Greece. If you keep on pumping that much money into the Greek economy, one asks oneself, why were they only growing at 4% if you're pumping in nearly 16% of additional resources? But, of course, at that stage, we were not well prepared for anything of that sort. In the beginning, we thought this is a fiscal crisis, and over the years, it's developed into a sovereign debt crisis, into a banking crisis, a financial crisis, a euro area crisis. So we've had quite a lot of different crises over the past 10 years, and sometimes forget that it all started in a way with U.S. monetary policy and transatlantic financial interlinkages. But be that as it may, the euro area was also institutionally not prepared for any kind of problem of this sort, as the euro had been built on the erroneous assumption that there could be no harmful current account imbalances between member states. And if there are no such dangers, you also don't need any instruments to overcome these problems. So, no recognition, no instrument, no process, no procedure, no institutions. So we went on and on, more or less inventing things on the go. Initially, because of the no bailout provisions of the EU treaty, we couldn't even use or even invent any EU instruments. We had to cobble together the so-called Greek loan facility, which was a hodgepodge of 15 different bilateral loans which were administered by the Commission. And it was only later that we then started founding new institutions, which now have a huge firing power of several hundred billions of euro, that we set up a single supervisor for the banking system of the euro area and quite a number of other stabilization instruments and stabilization policies. But of course, we've gone through quite a number of metamorphoses, and probably the most interesting part of the Greek saga was in mid-2015, but even before, we had a couple of years of educational experiences.
Was there a moment where you really thought that Grexit might happen? As your colleagues say about you, you stay very calm under fire and sort of keep the ship on a steady course. Was there a moment where a few beads of sweat emerged and you thought maybe this is all actually quite literally going to go south?
We had two episodes. The one was in 2012 and the other one was in 2015. In 2012, I never actually believed that Greece would really be leaving the euro. But in 2015, I thought, well, can't exclude it. The difference between the two episodes was that in 2012 the contagion effects would have been very significant, whereas in 2015 it would have remained an isolated incident of a country leaving the euro area. But it would not have been good. The euro should and is irreversible.
If we'd have approached Brexit in 2012, then there would have been a bigger contagion effect, a bigger fallout than if it would have happened in 2015. How difficult were the discussions at that stage? Because that really, obviously, as you said, the first bailout had been based around bilateral loans in 2010. This was using euro area bailout instruments. It involved a big private sector haircut on holdings of Greek sovereign debt. How difficult were those discussions? And is it possible to sort of, to talk us through a couple of the key moments actually inside the room, inside the Eurogroup meeting of finance ministers?
Probably in 2012, the most difficult discussions were those around the so-called private sector initiative, which is a acronymical euphemism for the haircut for private investors, and which was one of the, I think, the largest ever sovereign bond restructuring and bail-in in modern history. And what people love to forget is that it resulted in a huge debt to GDP cut for the Greeks. And ultimately, it also resulted in the euro area holding most of Greek debt. So getting that right, getting the discussion between the private sector and the public sector, between the IMF, the ECB, the Greeks, the Commission, finding an equilibrium solution was extremely difficult. There had been a first attempt in late 2011, which was aborted when politicians reflected on the provisional result and came to the conclusion that the haircut was simply too small. And so we had another go at it.
Yeah.
And those were extremely hairy discussions. And they were more difficult with the IMF, which was insisting on deeper and deeper and deeper haircuts. On the other side, the private sector, which was pushing back as much as they could with the voice that you may have or may not have in these situations. And member states who also had to chip in money of their own, not only persuading the private sector. So that was something which kept us occupied, not only for the many, many endless hours in the meeting rooms, but for days, weeks, and months in preparing it and then dealing with the fallout. But through all of that, there was always the difference of opinion between those who said the euro area as such is firm and nobody can leave, no matter what, as opposed to others who said the stability of the euro and the euro area depends on rules, not only on institutions such as the ECB. And if people again and again and again do not respect the rules, then don't change the rules, change the composition of the euro. And that was the big discussion of 2012. None of the institutions was advocating this course, let alone the then chair of the Eurogroup, Jean-Claude Juncker. But there were a couple of ministers who were firmly convinced that for Europe and the euro as a whole, it would be better if there were a parting of ways.
Who were they in particular?
Yes, exactly. well, very, very interesting debates. They were not dogmatic. They were really of a very high economic and intellectual caliber. And finally, in the end, all of these ministers appeared to be genuinely convinced that it would be better if Greece were to remain a member of the euro area. So that was more a behind-the-scene discussion and intellectual exercise, and we will never know if there would have ever been any practical consequences if the intellectual discussion had gone differently. That was a very, very interesting episode, which in 20 years' time we'll be able to write about in more detail.
Was your personal view that the economic consequences were containable had there been a an exit?
My view at the time were that I would not feel confident in predicting that they would have been containable. I would not ever say they are uncontainable, but I would say there is a very high probability that they would not be containable. So it's no matter what you think of the morality or the politics, in simply in terms of risk management, it's not a clever thing to do.
Does that mean then, in some ways, was Greece closer to leaving in 2012 than it was in 2015? Because in 2015, there was a moment where the Germans and I think others, kind of hiding a little bit behind the Germans, were on board with a plan for at least a temporary Grexit. But it came and went quite quickly, that moment, whereas it sounds like in 2012 there was more of a prolonged discussion about it.
I would actually think that in 2015 they were considerably closer, because in 2012 the Greeks wanted to stay in. But in 2015, the Greeks, or at least the Greek government, or at least significant parts of the Greek government, were giving a very professional and convincing image of wanting to leave the euro. So there were quite a couple of ministers who said, well, if that's what they want, let's help them along, if that's what they really want. And not that I ever really understood the formulation of the question in the referendum. The Greek referendum, it's a bit like, does the Thames flow uphill or downhill, yes and no? Something like that. And it's not quite correct that it was a very narrow slot in time when this was of relevance, because they'd been building up the discussions or the non-discussions or the dogmatic monologues or whatever you want to call it. All of that had been building up since January or February. And so July, beginning of July, was the culmination and was not the only point in time when they gave that impression.
You must have seen a dramatic change in the kind of tenor of that discussion between ministers. The atmosphere can't have been the same towards the end of this crisis than it was at the beginning. And you know, have they emerged as a more open, functioning, coherent body than they entered a crisis like Greece? You know, the kind of cordiality and things obviously didn't survive a lot of the crisis, but do you think that actually mattered in the effectiveness?
Well, cordiality can be an indicator of absence of problems or negation of problems. So if utter cordiality had remained with the Eurogroup throughout the crisis, you might have accused ministers or the group as such of totally missing it. But what really struck me is that the arguments never got bitter. And very, very seldom, with one or two very notable exceptions, people were not dogmatic, but gave fairly good reasons why they were for or against a certain course of action. And all of those you could understand against the political background of their specific country, against the background of history of the country and the politics of the country. And it is only natural that somebody coming from Finland or the Netherlands would have a different reasoning than the minister from Spain or Italy or Malta for that. So it never got personal, never ever, with one or two notable exceptions.
Riga. I think you've Yanis Varoufakis.
Riga in 2015.
Whatever. I'm just saying that the vast majority of relationships were good, and people who'd had a heated discussion across the table went off and had a beer afterwards.
You have mentioned before that there were missteps made. I mean, you can't go through a long crisis like this without making some missteps. What do you think they were in the case of the Eurogroup? And if there was a visa time machine, what would you go and adjust and do differently?
I think personally, I realized too late the degree of debt relief that one would have given Greece right at the outset, comma, with the proviso, had this not been in the midst of the global financial crisis. And if we had at that stage, and the same goes for Ireland, incidentally, if we had haircut and bailed in a vast amount of the creditors at that stage, it is not only possible but probable that we would have seen a cataclysmical event for not only European but also global banking. But I must say, in all self-criticism, we did the right thing, I think, at the time, but not because we were so clever, but simply because we misjudged somehow the situation. And I once asked Jean-Claude Trichet, who'd been around for many, many years, I said, why did the Maastricht Treaty not foresee provisions on such things as banking union, a single supervisor, or instruments to deal with balance of payments adjustment problems? And he looked at me and said, young man, there is a slight age difference, young man, it was all in the first draft, but the politicians took these things out. So people were clever enough, end of the 80s, and they saw what might be happening. But many of these things, many of these instruments, many of these procedures, they are problematical because they take away national autonomy over quite central policy areas. And end of the 80s, beginning of the 90s, it was unthinkable to politicians and central bankers to give up total autonomy over banking supervision. And we see exactly where that led to. Banking supervision was first and foremost an industrial policy instrument, which is, if it is done in Albania or in North Korea, is fine. But in a highly integrated internal market, there has to be a high degree of coordination and cooperation, of convergence of rules. Convergence is very important these days, always was. And that is what they wouldn't give up. And that's also the big reason, to my mind, why the US got out of the financial crisis so much faster than us, because they had one supervisor, one finance minister, and they called the banks together and said, you're being recapitalized with government money, as in the UK. Whereas in the euro area, with very stringent competition policies, the individual banker did not want to be recapitalized intensively by the state, because otherwise they would have had to change the business model. So we had these national responses, which ended up with the whole financial sector on the continent not having been recapitalized to such a degree that they could get rid of non-performing loans and get on with lending. So that was the big difference between the US and Europe.
That the US did TARP and actually went in and sorted out the banks, whereas in Europe we didn't.
Absolutely.
And given the kind of imperfections, to say the least, in the kind of structure you were working with, did you feel uncomfortable at times at having, you know, in a position that's not as democratically accountable as would be ideal, to have to stitch together responses that really, you know, it's the life of death of a country, of their politics, kind of stitching that together here? I mean, did that make you feel uncomfortable? Or seeing it in action, where a central response had to be kind of brought together, even if it's not kind of in the architecture of the system?
Democratic accountability. The Eurogroup is an institution, or if you so want, a gathering of 19 different ministers who represent their member states. And each of them is, as individual and as a member of their government, is responsible to their national parliament. So we had an embarrassade de richesse. We had such democratic accountability that at times the problem was rather that we had to move so slowly until all of the parliaments had agreed. And some parliaments worked more rapidly and others less rapidly. Some were slightly superficial and some went into very, very granular detail on wanting to know different aspects of each and every of the programs we were running. Democratic accountability was there to the maximum. The European Parliament has been saying that there's not enough democratic accountability, by which they probably mean that there is not enough involvement of the European Parliament. But seeing as how national budgets are involved, I quite fail to see what the accountability could be. Except, And that probably is something that could be changed, except for more regular and systematic hearings, such as that of the ECB president. But budgetary sovereignty and budgetary responsibility is and remains with each of the individual ministers. That, of course, is a problem. You have unanimity requirements there. And that is probably one of the reasons for criticism coming from the Commission and one or two member states that say, if we continue to rely on unanimity in a next crisis, we will have to move faster than we've been doing at times in the past crisis. So we would like to have different decision-making mechanisms, institutional setups and the like, but that'll be extremely difficult. So what is the relationship between creditor countries and debtor countries?
Yeah, the treatment of debtor countries.
Right. Ultimately, formally speaking, it is the national parliament that endorses the Memorandum of Understanding and produces it. It is the paper that the government owns and votes on. But of course, it doesn't do so by plucking it out of thin air. And there is always, in the short run, a trade-off between what the institutions, globally the IMF, and with us, ECB, Commission, now ESM as well, what they think as being the necessary and sufficient economic policy responses to preventing such reversal of capital flows happening again. And you probably want to make sure that not only the superficial problems and bottlenecks disappear, but also the other structural impediments to growth, flexibility, etc. Which always implies that such an adjustment program addresses more than just fiscal or more than just banking, but it goes into the structure of policies and especially economic policies. The decision on Ireland, it was not uncontested. There were some people in some institutions who would have preferred a bail-in of creditors. But you need to remember back to the times when these discussions were being held. The financial crisis was still on. And as was the case with the first Greek program, the environment was not so stable that you would have said, I feel very comfortable with bailing in the creditors, and therefore this is what we will do. Of course, this has enormous distributional consequences because you shift the adjustment burden from the balance sheet of creditor banks to the balance sheet of the Irish sovereign. And so it's a trade-off between long-run financial sustainability in Ireland versus presumed global financial stability. And this was a discussion which was especially intense between, I must say, in full fairness, parts of the IMF and the ECB, and also the Commission, but predominantly between the IMF and the ECB. And in the end, as we know, the concerns about global financial stability won out. But even within the IMF, I think you would find people who were advocating the one solution versus the other. So we'll never know if the alternative would have worked very well or if it would have ended up in significant financial volatility.
But in that case, how difficult was it to take the decision on Cyprus when that, at least for me, that was a landmark moment where the euro area said, well, actually, we are going to bail in senior bondholders at banks in these kinds of crisis situations where effectively the banks can't support themselves anymore. Initially, you know, I think partly to do with the way that the results of the discussions were presented, maybe there was quite a lot of worry or quite a lot of anxiety in the markets about how that was going to play out. But then that then seemed to become the template for what we did afterwards.
I would never use the word template there. So you're talking about events which took place in early 2013 when the Irish program, I can't remember, was it already? I think it was over already at the times. And financial markets were back to a much, much healthier position. The Cyprus banking sector had gotten into these difficulties so spectacularly due to short-term speculation by speculating on Greek government bonds, that it seemed more logical at the time to have a bail-in of creditors than it had been 3 years before. And as history shows, it was an eminently containable exercise. Cyprus is doing very well. Without the bail-in, we were talking about a program in the range of probably without bail-in, well beyond 100% of GDP, very well beyond 100% of GDP. And a large part of those program proposals were hope-based and not fact-based, in the sense that they rested on very rapidly emerging flow of royalties from gas findings close to Cyprus. When I last looked, the ships were still hovering above water, but without any access to the gas.
We live in hope. But you mentioned the banking union earlier, and I mean, did the Cyprus deal in a way pave the way for the banking union? And I was speaking with Jeroen Dijsselbloem, the former Eurogroup president, recently, and he said really that the banking union is the unheralded hero, if you like, of the sovereign debt crisis, that it played a very big role in re-establishing confidence in the banks. How far would you go along with that?
Well, the sequencing was that banking union started in mid-2012. And that was when, in the June Euro summit, if I remember correctly, the decision in principle was taken to have a single supervisor. And already at the end of the summer, the proposal was there, and we moved towards the single supervisor and important parts of the rule book that supported that. So you may say that the Cyprus decision was already a consequence of the emerging banking union.
I see, it's the other way around. So even though it came before, it was the first big instance of using senior bondholder bail-in outside of a couple of cases in Denmark. The banking union was already in.
And Spain. There had already been incidents in Spain. So it was nothing completely new, but as such an integral part of a program, it was indeed new.
Okay. And the banking union and its role? Because a lot of the discussion in Brussels now is about how the banking union as a project is still incomplete. We have the European Central Bank supervising banks. We have a new system for dealing with bank crises. But there are other parts of it that are on the table, like a deposit guarantee scheme that are still pending. What has the banking union actually contributed so far, do you think, to financial stability?
I would say it was the missing part of economic and monetary union. And if something really world-class came out of the crisis, it is banking union indeed. And I would say that 90%, 95% of it are here and working. As you said, deposit insurance is still not unified. I'm very optimistic that, depending on the German coalition agreement, of course, but that we'll be able to get there, at least in principle, by mid-year. But by and large, it is there. And the missing jewel in the crown, if you so want, is the deposit insurance scheme, which will bring with it a couple of other side conditions and side instruments. But if that were to be the only legacy of the crisis, we would have emerged with something very good. We've also emerged, of course, with the European Stability Mechanism, with global rules that make banks safer and more stable. And we've emerged from the crisis with a very, very strong and even stronger political commitment to the euro as a whole. And that is what people, especially across the Atlantic, did not appear to fully realize, that it is an eminently political project. And it's not just some economic thingamajig which has been sort of glued together haphazardly, but it's a deeply political project. And as such, it's here to stay and safe and stable. But we've gone through a quite, some say existential, some say very interesting, I'd rather say extremely interesting crisis. And having survived that volatility makes us that much stronger.
The banking union in particular, you know, that's one of the most fundamental decisions I've seen taken by the EU in my time here, certainly. I've seen impact assessments on everything from olive oil jugs to tiny changes to regulation across the continent. Something like banking union emerged, it was probably no more than half a side of paper, as I remember it, in the early hours of the morning. Explain to folks who don't understand how this system works. Why is it that these miracles happen in the early hours? And what is it about the dynamics of these kind of meetings that make that a kind of habit?
We were in the first semester of 2012 discussing one of the several policy instruments that the European Stability Mechanism could use. And one of those that were under discussion was the so-called direct recapitalization instrument, i.e. that the ESM could directly recapitalize a bank in a member state without having to go through a formal balance of payment adjustment program. And there were some who very much advocated that, and there were some more of the Calvinist or Protestant persuasion who said there's no way that we let this happen because there's such a high degree of moral hazard involved. You might possibly even let your banks go run into problems, give as much credit to the economy as possible, and once they're in deep trouble, call in the troops and have them recapitalized at the expense of the European taxpayer. So this was a discussion that went around in circles for months on end. And in the end, at a G20 summit in Los Cabos in Mexico, there was a discussion which President Obama initiated, calling together a couple of the European heads and saying, you must make progress with direct recapitalization of the ESM, which is a degree of detail and granularity,
I was gonna say, yeah.
Which one doesn't always expect from all American presidents.
I can see Trump ringing up and wanting to go through some finer points of how bailout mechanisms in the euro area might work.
Quite. In the end, this led to another meeting of four or five prime ministers in Rome shortly after the G20 summit, who put together their finance ministers not much later and told them to have a look at this. And somebody pulled a white rabbit out of the hat and said, well, I would agree to the instrument if we had a single supervisor. So we looked at each other and said, well, okay, let's have a single supervisor. And within a week, if I remember correctly, that was a week or so before the Euro summit, we had worked out the principles of what might need to be accomplished. And then there were heavy debates at the Euro summit, of course, which went on, if I remember correctly, until 5 in the morning.
Yeah.
And in the end, that's how it all started.
And one of the, I mean, that is one of the biggest decisions to pull sovereignty we've seen probably since the creation of the single currency.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it shows that you can have political agreements if they are well prepared and you don't need hundreds of pages of preparatory documentation gone through by the experts, which may, in some instances, may actually inhibit progress and not further progress.
So given that Greece is now about to exit its third and everyone expects final bailout program, what is the state of Greece now? How much has Greece repaired as a result of the economic adjustment programs it had as a condition of its bailouts? And how do you see Greece's sustainability going forward?
Well, it's 2018. I would say that in 2015, Greece was flat on their back. And 15 was very difficult. 16 was difficult. 17 was better, and 18 is good. So I would say Greece, they're now on their knees, and I'm very confident that they will be able to get back on their feet and walk alone. And I've repeatedly been asked, why do you not intervene in the education system, the judicial system, this, that, and the other? And the purpose of such programs is to alleviate those short-term problems and those factors which led to the reversal of capital flows in the first instance. Mm. They're not there to change a society. That's for the Greek people, or the Irish people, or the Spanish people, or the Portuguese people, or the Korean people to do for themselves and by themselves. And otherwise, this would be catastrophic for democracy. So you come in, you try and fix the short-term problems, and the long-term issues are for the country themselves to deal with. So Greece can have a great future. They have many talents. They are geographically well situated to profit from the coming decades. And if they will actually manage to do so depends on, of course, primarily on politics. Will the Greek people get an administrative system and administration that is fast and predictable? Will there be a judicial system which is the same? Is the educational system geared to the challenges of the 21st century or not? All of this is possible, as it is possible in many of our societies. Will Greece become the Luxembourg of southeastern Europe? Obviously not. But there are alternative development paths, and I am hopeful that Greek politics will choose and enable the more benign development paths. And for that, the state has to become less clientelistic than it is. I would like to believe that it has become less clientelistic than it was before the crisis, which essentially was one of the reasons why it actually got into the crisis.
You'd like to be, but do you really see that at the moment?
I'm never certain of, hardly ever certain of anything except my preference for powdered snow.
Okay, to conclude, one abstract question and one quite visual one. The abstract one, are there intrinsic flaws in the construction of the euro area and the euro?
In retrospect, in 2008, 2010, we should have been more vocal on the problems posed by the absence of a banking union, of highly integrated financial markets, with the regulatory and supervisory framework that is required. I would say now we are there where we should be. There are still quite a number of nice-to-haves, but there is not a single need-to-have missing at this stage.
And a visual one. What's your abiding image of these crisis years?
The crisis meetings.
Thinking back, indeed, in 10 years' time, there must be one or two images that are really imprinted on your mind from that period.
Keep cool, have another summit.
And that's the end of this week's show. Let us know what you think. You can email us at alphachat@ft.com. Please rank and review the show on Apple Podcasts. It really, really helps other people find out about us. Jim and Alex are both on Twitter. You can find Jim at Jim Brunsden, and Alex is at Alex E. Barker. Thanks again to Jim and Alex and to Thomas Wieser. We'll see you here next week for another episode of Alpha Chat.
The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is out now, and it's all about AI and creativity. I speak to Doug Eck, Senior Research Director at Google DeepMind.
Creativity is part and parcel of humanity.
YouTube creator Danny Vidari.
AI can give us humans new ideas.
And Neil Maiden, Professor of Digital Creativity at City University London.
AI creates a lot of opportunities. I think it's a great leveler.
Listen to the full episode of The Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts. Enjoy.
The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is all about health prevention and vaccines. I speak to Kate Hashey at GSK.
For every dollar invested in improving health, there's an economic return of $2 to $4.
Murray Aitken at IQVIA Institute for Human Data Science.
The benefits of adult vaccination are compelling.
And David Sinclair at the International Longevity Centre.
Preventable conditions amongst those aged 50 to 64 in the UK cost $27 billion a year.
Listen to the full episode of the Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts.